Good afternoon. This is Alexis, and welcome to the Surgery Endorsement Maintenance Steering Committee meeting. On today's call, the committee will be reviewing the 35 comments received during the Phase 1 public and member comment period, which ended on July 12th. And following that discussion, the committee will continue its review of the Phase 2 measures. And before we get started, I would just like to make the committee aware of the table of responses document that I sent last week with the call materials. I just wanted to note that we'll only be discussing the measures we did not get to discuss on the last call, and those measures that we are discussing on today's call is also located on the agenda. And now I would like to turn the call over to Melinda Murphy.
Thanks, Alexis. I really don't have anything in particular to add other than to say, as a result of some of the questions from the developers on the last call, we did also include by number and title the measures that would be discussed related to Phase 2 so that you have a sense of when your measure will be discussed in terms of order. And as Alexis said, the 35 comments that we have will be the first item for discussion, and we've allocated an hour for that discussion. Again, so everyone on the call has a sense of timing that Hi. We're working toward for the call.
Hi, Vivian Halpern here. I just got in.
Hi, and welcome. And that's it. I would turn to Dr. Morris and Dr. Torchiana.
Good morning, everybody. Or it's not morning anymore, is it? It's all morning. We're going to go ahead and talk about the comments from our leftover from our last meeting. David, how would you prefer to proceed with these?
Well, my sense would be if we're going to look at the comment report as the one that's headed comments received as of 7/12, that what we might try to do is to categorize the comments and cluster them a little bit. So that we can actually get through this discussion in an hour. And I would say just as a preliminary stab at that, it's clear that there are two prevailing comments in the early part of this packet, one of which is requesting that the STS consider more reporting of individual clinician measurement. And then the second one is concern about the systematic database for cardiac surgery being a valid measure. And then I guess the third one would be concern about hierarchical modeling and whether it causes more obscuring of differences than it does accurately depicting valid comparisons. So unless others have other comments, maybe if we could try to address those three, potentially both with those that made the comments, if they're available, and also the STS developer. I heard Dave Shaheen is one of the people on the line. We might be able to do this a little bit more succinctly.
Hi, everyone. Just to let you know, it's Renee Stafford. I joined the call.
And Dr. Torchiana and Dr. Morris, it's Melinda. What you see in the table is a proposed response from the steering committee that I just wanted to point out that staff put together those proposed responses, but in your deliberations, they certainly can be changed. At the end of the process, the table, along with the response that is settled upon, will be posted on the website.
Okay.
So if we start with 841, though I have this printed, I probably should go to the website, and the proposed steering committee response is actually truncated in my printed version, so I'm not sure what we are suggesting.
Can you say that? Which was your number you just were referring to again?
841.
It's ID number 841. It's on, if you're looking at the document online, it's on row 6.
Okay. Oh, okay. So in the Excel file.
Correct.
I was looking at the DF of the table of responses. Okay, and so to start off here, Melinda, did you envision that we would look at the proposed steering committee response and then people would have room for discussion, or how did
assuming that people have had the opportunity to review the response from the developers, then I thought that that might facilitate movement forward.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes.
Okay. I'm having trouble with my right now. So at 8:41, I'm having trouble leading this because I'm having trouble with my computer. We discussed their responses. We had our steering committee response. We support the suggestion that the measures be reported at the clinician level that take into account patient risk factors. And we will have a white paper forthcoming. Is there anything else that we need to do with this? Can you guys hear me okay?
Yep.
This is Helen. It might be helpful to hear from Dr. Shaheen or any of the people who made the comments briefly.
I'd be happy to respond, or we can, if the person that made the comment wishes to start, that'd be fine.
Hello. It sounded like someone was trying to respond. I think, Dr. Shaheen, it's probably fine for you to go ahead.
No, I'd be happy to. This is obviously a controversial issue, the pros and cons of which I would say have not yet been resolved, but our thoughts are as follows. First of all, even in cardiac surgery, where surgeons typically do perform a fair number of procedures of one type, small sample sizes are an issue, and certainly for the rest of medicine and surgery, it is a very substantial issue to have enough procedures or diagnoses of one type to discriminate performance. Secondly, cardiac surgery really is a team endeavor, and if I was going to have heart surgery done, I would want to be interested in the best overall team, because I can go to the best heart surgeon in the world, and if the rest of the team, anesthesia, critical care, whatever, are not up to the same standards, then I may well have a suboptimal result. So it's the whole team that we ought to be looking at. And third, and I think a very considerable concern is of surgeon level reporting is risk aversion. We see this in general, that is the fear that report cards will make you less likely to take on high-risk patients who may in fact be the ones that will benefit most. When you're reporting at the group level or the hospital level, the results of that uncommon but very high-risk patient will be diluted within the results of the entire group. If it's Dr. Shaheen that's being reported on, then he is going to have even more potential for avoiding that extremely high-risk patient because it's going to be his personal report card. We really don't want to see patients denied care. There is some evidence from Rachel Werner that risk aversion may disproportionately impact minorities. So this is a very important issue. So for all those reasons, we continue to believe that reporting at the hospital group group level is best. And if you're reporting at the hospital or group level and things like reimbursement are based on your group or hospital performance, we believe that the hospital or group will have a very substantial incentive to ferret out any low-performing individual surgeons and deal with that internally.
So, Dr. Sheehan, it's Renee Stafford. I just have a question. So if you are reporting at the hospital or the group level, if those members of the group wanted to get the data fed back to them individually on an individual basis for internal benchmarking, is that feasible?
Absolutely. All the vendor software, there are, I think, 16 vendors now for the STS, but all of them have the capability for the individual site to generate those data almost instantly. So the answer is yes, and I would think any responsible department chair would do exactly that.
Right. I mean, I would think that would be useful for an ongoing, you know, professional performance evaluation that's
Absolutely.
Now required.
Absolutely, Renee. Agree completely.
Other comments on this? You know, I would say that the position that Dr. Sheehan just espoused is one that probably most surgeons would line up behind. The proposed steering committee response is not exactly in line with what Dr. Sheehan just described, however.
And I think what Renee just suggested might be a way to modify the response. First of all, I would perhaps at the committee's discretion, they might say that the societies consider clinician-level reporting when it's appropriate, taking all these things in consideration, but that and also put some language in there about it being the responsibility of department, division, hospital leadership to review individual clinician-level information.
So Dr. Torchian, if the group is comfortable with changes that reflect what they've just heard, we can make those. And whenever we go through all of these suggested responses, we will send it back to the committee to confirm that we got it right.
That sounds great, Melinda. Thank you.
So then, Dr. Torchiana, if you are you going to move down the list, or did you want to go in a different order as you had described earlier?
Well, it seems to me that they're clustered to some degree. So if I notice that the screen has moved on the computer, but I think. I'm looking at the printed page, and so.
Essentially, if you look at the response that you just that we just discussed, and move
of 841 and all that are similar to 841, I would guess is what you're driving at.
Correct.
Okay.
So that would take you down to row 15.
Okay.
015 is?
It's ID number 826.
Okay. Got it.
So this makes sense to me, I guess, rather than cluster. We'll just assume that those that are clustered, once we've answered it, once we've answered all of them. So this is a comment on reserve status. For measures that are topped out.
Yes.
And could you scroll the computer screen down? Oh, the committee response is on the top. That transparency is important for all users, proper use and understanding of the measure and results of its use. Doesn't sound like much to disagree with there.
Comment went to the question of transparency, so the response was simply an agreement with the commenter that transparency is indeed important. So it did not require any consideration even of any other change.
Now, I'm trying to understand the context of the STS response, which was basically to say that it was audited and there was a high correlation, I guess, between the audit and the original report. So I don't see any reason not to move on to the next comment.
Okay, so the next one is ID number 818 on row 16. And this was a request for addition of age in the measure description and denominator. And STS responded by saying they would make the requested modification to a number of the measures that are listed there for you.
Okay. That one sounds like it's been addressed.
And it also notes that NQF is working on developing additional guidance to promote standardization across measure descriptions.
Sounds good.
Okay. So then moving forward to ID number 834 on row 18, and this was a question related to registries. The commenter says they oppose endorsement of measure 113, and measure 113 is the participation in a systematic database for cardiac surgery, and the committee will recall that the recommendation was endorsement and placement in reserve status.
Yeah, the reserve status was because there was no gap. Is that right?
The gap was very small. Performance was at 95%.
Right. This is Arden. I finally got back on the line. I think that our concern was that while performance is very good currently across the board, that it may slip over time if it's no longer monitored. So there may be a role for this measure in the future, a quality improvement role for this measure in the future, and that it would be desirable not to basically banish it entirely, but just have it in a place where it could be reenacted. Am I remembering that correctly?
You are.
Okay, yeah, that makes complete sense to me.
I wonder if we want the response, though, to be a little bit stronger as far as agreeing with the performance of 95% and the, you know, the fact that there's a minimum gap, you know, just agreeing with the writer that that's true. That's why it was placed in reserve. We don't really say why. We just say that registries are a mechanism for benchmarking, and that's the premise that retains it in reserve status. But we don't really provide an explanation for what reserve status is or why it's going there.
I think that adding that would be a very good idea, because in the future somebody will be looking at this and probably not understand that background. I think it could probably be put in succinctly in about two sentences, and it would be worthwhile.
I think that's a great point. Having a registry that has 95% penetrance makes it a more valuable registry than one that has 10%, and so I think reemphasizing that point is a good idea.
Okay, we can do that. And again, you'll see the revision in order to determine that you're satisfied with it.
Okay.
And then that response will also cover a number of subsequent comments if you look down the list. So the next item that you will go to is ID number 832 on line 23. And we've already dealt with the question of measure 113, because this comment addresses two things. So 113 is already taken care of, and the key in the remainder of the comment is encouraging the steering committee to endorse measure 0124, which was the surgical volume measure.
Mm-hmm.
And you see right above the proposed steering committee response, the STS response.
I think it's Renee. We had a pretty robust discussion about this at the in-person meeting, and I think we all pretty much came to the conclusion that there wasn't enough data to make volume a reliable indicator for this, at least at this point.
Right. Yeah, we all agreed on that. I don't really see that we need to discuss this one further. Anybody else?
I guess, Arden, the only thing that I might say is that we might want to change the language a little bit. You know, that we've been consistent in the position that volume alone cannot convey enough information about quality, continues in that belief with respect, perhaps, to this procedure. Do we want to be specific about it? Because there are some procedures that we talked about that there is some volume data for.
Right, esophagectomy, pancreatectomy.
Right, right.
That's true. You know, I hate to revise each of these things, but I think you're really right. I think that is an important addition. What would be the appropriate language for that? I would hesitate to just say that it's volume alone cannot convey information about quality for common procedures. I would hate to use that language because it's kind of too broad.
Right.
Maybe just for CABG.
Right, and we could say that we could say something about the discussion. We discussed it, reviewed the literature, and didn't feel there was enough data to support.
There's not enough data to support it. I think that the vast amount of data does not support it.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. I guess I do agree with you that we should.
Or maybe we should say something like, you know, because you're then eliminating the other ones where also the data was not necessarily strong for volume alone as a quality measure, is to say something along that, you know, even with other procedures, volume alone must be looked at with caution or something as a quality measure by itself.
Sure.
Or something along those lines.
Yeah, okay, I think that that's... Although it's sort of, in some ways, if you urge caution, that doesn't really provide some useful information for people looking at this in the future. That's the only downside. I guess, you know, what we're really looking for here is we think that volume alone is insufficient for anything except those infrequent procedures for which volume has been shown to be sufficient.
Yeah, I like that.
I agree. I'm not too crazy about the word caution. I think it's very vague. It doesn't really convey what we want to in here. It's going to mean very different to this people.
Melinda, should we be really trying to draft our response here? Is this an appropriate thing for us to be doing, or should we leave this to the
It's perfectly appropriate for you to do it to the extent that you're comfortable in doing so. If you give us the gist of what you want to see reflected, we will work to revise the language again so you can look at it. So you do not have to specify every word you want to see in it at this point.
Okay. Do you guys, Alexis or whoever would be revising the language, do you feel like you have a sense of what we're after?
Yes.
Okay. Can we move on?
Yes.
Great.
So the next one, again, refers to 113 and 124 and speaks to the question of registries. So there is an additional response there, which you may or may not feel is necessary.
I'm sorry, what was that, 124?
124 is the surgical volume.
Okay.
That includes CABG valves, CABG plus valve.
And the ID number, this is 810.
That's correct.
Thanks, David.
So I think we could use the same response that we've devised for all the other questions about participation in a registry, and then we can use this most recent response for the information about volume, because those are the two things they're getting at.
Okay.
All right.
And then the next one down is going to pick up the response again that the group agrees
yep.
to. So you can go on to ID number 804 on row 26. And this is about the measure related to post-op renal failure.
Looks like it's appropriate to me.
Okay, so Dr. Morris, Dr. Porciana, if the group agrees it's appropriate, are you ready to move on?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay. Melinda,
if I could just say that there's sort of two questions here. One is about the bundling of complications. The other is about the portrayal of the results of the bundling in a star system. And it seems like the comment addresses the fact that the star rating is not part of the endorsed standard, but it might be good to say a little something about the notion of a bundling complications too. I mean, what people are looking for is for greater discrimination, and that's one of the values of bundling things in this way. Maybe I'm splitting hairs here.
It was not addressed in the proposed response. Since that did not clearly come through in the comment per se, but as you know, STS did speak to it in their response. So if the group feels that that's some additional verbiage should be there to address that, we can certainly include it.
Yeah, I just think some encouragement on this concept of bundling complications together to allows some power to discriminate is a positive. It's an initiative that ought to be encouraged, I think.
I agree.
Okay. We'll work on the language there, and you'll want to look particularly at that whenever it comes back.
Thank you.
Okay, sure. So then the next one is ID number 805 on row 27, and this is risk-adjusted surgical re-exploration. And this does, both in the comment and the response, speaks directly to bundling.
I think that's a good response.
Yeah.
I agree.
Okay. So then this goes to the question of age specification, which STS had responded to and was recorded at the top of the document, where they had said that they would make that change in adding the age specification. So this one seems real straightforward, and that there's not anything else to do unless the group wants additional language. Are you okay with that one?
Yes.
Yes.
And the same thing is true on the next one, which is a different measure, but the same issue, and STS has already agreed that it will make the change, and that is true with ID number 822. So if you go to ID number 806 on line 32, this is related to the risk-adjusted stroke CVA.
So this is basically the same thing as previously.
Yeah.
As the renal failure. Yeah, I would agree.
Okay, so you would like to see it most closely mirror that one. Correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The next one, again, is age specification. And this was specific to the CMS measure 0218. And CMS, in their response, did not indicate that they would include it in the measure description and denominator statement. We have gone back to CMS to encourage them, even in light of their response, to do so. And also made note there that NQF is working on developing additional guidance to improve standardization.
I think it's all very reasonable.
Yeah.
I agree.
Okay. The next one. ID number 807 on line 34, again, that's measure 218. The reference is to measure 218, and it's speaking to the use of factor 10A inhibitor and the guidelines for VTE prophylaxis. So there you see the CMS response and the proposed committee response that supports what CMS has said.
I agree with this response.
So do I.
Yeah.
The next one, again, is measure 218. And it really is saying as much as anything that we've addressed the question of prophylaxis earlier. You've just done that. And this says that it seems to be inappropriately placed in the report, and we're saying we will put it under a different heading.
Right.
Okay.
Okay. Again, the next two relate to the age specification and the STS measures, which we've already addressed. STS is making that change. So then if you go to ID number 816 on line 38, and this is the question of modifying the time frame for evaluation of glucose control in the cardiac surgery patient. This actually was a little odd in that it is a CMS measure with the change agreed to with CMS during the discussion, and the comment comes from CMS. So you see there the response from CMS whenever we sent the comment over and the proposed response. So are you okay with that, or do you want the group to look back at the time interval?
My recollection was there was additional rationale for the later interval and specifically against the earlier interval, but I can't for the life of me remember exactly what it was. But I thought there was a pretty good justification, which isn't included here, which escapes my memory.
Right, we talked about this at length, and I'm trying to remember as well, is it for folks who have sugars that are difficult to control at first, something else going on? I don't remember. We talked about it for a while.
Right, and one of the things that that the representative who was on the call talked about is that in the algorithm to collect the information for the measure, that it will pick up the earlier time frames as well.
As I recall, you know, and there may have been more, but the part I remember was just having something consistent, and that 6 a.m. isn't consistent.
Right.
Yes.
8 to 12 hours certainly seems reasonable to me since they're comfortable making that change.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I think we were talking about how some cases end very early and some cases will end very, very late.
Yeah.
So what is that?
That was definitely the conversation, that the delta between the end of case and the first sugar is could be as far as 12 hours difference, depending on when
right.
they get to the operating room.
So I'm trying to understand, is this one CMS person critiquing another? It looks like both the response that we got that led to the 18 to 24 hours was a CMS recommendation, and it looks like the commenter is from CMS as well.
That's correct. So it's coming from different levels within the organization, and the information in terms of the change came through their technical panel. You remember that whenever the recommendation was made, the commitment was that they would go back to the technical panel for the discussion and brought it back after discussion with the technical panel. So it is the technical panel recommendation that's come through CMS, but you're right. The commenter and the developer all are representatives of CMS.
It doesn't seem to me like there's
So they're recommending 18 to 24 hours. I'm just trying to get this clear because they keep going back and forth.
Yeah, it's 18 to 24 hours now.
I think that's reasonable. It also means that you're going to control it for more than, you know, the first couple of hours after surgery.
Well, it sounds like there was an expert panel, technical panel, that proposed the 8 to 24 hours. I didn't see the 8 to 12 hours the comment is recommending. I didn't see any citation as far as the science for that time versus the 18 to 24, I'm sorry.
And the comment that's there is the complete comment. It has not been edited.
Yeah. I mean, 8 to 12 hours post-op, if somebody has the first heart of the day at 8 o'clock, they're out by 11. Even the previous 6 a.m. wasn't 8 hours. It was more like 20 hours. So
right.
It seems like 8 to 12 seems very short compared to even how we've been doing it.
Right.
And this is Helen Burris. I just checked the transcript for your meeting. You did have a very robust discussion of this. And, in fact, one of the issues Dr. Seema had raised was that it's the second day when they're off the insulin drip when it's really more challenging to keep them euglycemic, which I think was actually part of the idea of trying to go to a longer period.
Yes.
So it sounds like we're feeling we should just keep the recommendation as it is, 18 to 24.
Yes.
And we can get more clarification
for that.
CMS as well as to who's talking to who.
Okay, so we'll go back and pull in some of the additional detail from the transcript that makes more clear the committee's rationale for the determination and add that in.
I think it's also worth clarifying in the response that it's the 18 to 24 hours, because the way it's written, it's not sure which recommendation and so on is being approved.
Okay. Okay, shall do. Again, this one has ID number 842 was addressed with comment to 832, so we will modify. When we modify that one, that change will be reflected in the last two comments responses.
Sounds good.
And that works us through all of the comments. Actually, I would say the group did a really good job in being clear about what it was doing and why it was doing it as it went along. I think that 35 comments is a low number of comments. So I think you deserve congratulations. You did a really good job.
Thank you.
Sorry, the question about hierarchical modeling, did we skip that? It has clustered responses. This is 811. One of the comments was 838, but there are several others. Was item 838. I don't recall. Did we discuss that? I'm sorry if we did.
I don't remember discussing it. What line is that on?
The first place I see it cited in my printed out version is item 838. Mm-hmm. So if we could find 838.
It's on row 10.
Yes.
And the way in which it was addressed is by a reference to the response at 841, which is the first one. And it does talk about patient risk factors. It says the steering committee supports the suggestion that performance measures include measures to be reported at, and this is going to be modified, at clinician level and that take into account patient risk factors while ensuring that variations in care are not obscured by risk adjustment.
I missed that, Melinda. I guess I'd say I'm not sure hierarchical modeling is best described as risk adjustment. It's really more of a way in which comparisons are done. But that certainly, I think, gets at the gist of what it would be, the right response. So I'm happy with that.
Okay, and we'll bring that down to
who's got music on in the background?
We'll bring that piece down and insert it in that with that comment as well.
Sounds great. Thank you.
This is Dave Sheehan. Could I make one comment?
Certainly.
Several of the comments, or at least one of them I'm looking at now, present almost as a matter of fact that risk adjustment using hierarchical modeling obscures variation in provider performance. I think that a vast majority of statisticians would disagree with that. I've outlined some of that in our response. And there, in fact, is a group of presidents of statistical societies that will be issuing a white paper on this sometime probably later in the year. I wonder whether it wouldn't be worthwhile in the response to at least acknowledge that the comment raises an issue that is controversial and by no means as settled as the tone of the comment would suggest.
Yeah, and just to add to that, this is Helen Burston. We've also been having some ongoing discussions with the CSEC, plan to do additional work on the whole issue coming up in the fall. So I think it's important to couch it in the broader terms that this is by no means the only measure for which this is the approach. So, you know, we can't set policy measure by measure in this way. But we'll take a more thoughtful approach going forward.
Okay, so Dr. Morrison, Dr. Torchana, if you support what's just been said, we'll get that carried into the response related to hierarchical modeling comment, and also bring the notation that NQF will have a white paper from ID number 841 and repeat it there.
Great.
Okay. All right, we shall do that.
All right.
So then you have gone through all of the comments with the proposed actions and are ready to move to the continued review of the phase two measure follow-up.
Melinda, this is Helen. Is it worth if there is any public comment before you do that?
Sure. So Alexis, who is the assisting us today?
Melanie, could you open the lines so we can see if anyone has any comments regarding the discussion on the submitted comments for phase one measures, please?
All lines are open.
This is an opportunity for public comment on the previous discussion.
Sounds like you're good to go.
Okay.
Okay, so then if you're ready to turn to the document that is the table of responses that includes all of the phase two measures, and you will start with measure 1531 that is on page 24 of 49 of that document. And the group had just begun talking about this follow-up assessment of stroke or death after carotid revascularization, but really had not had much discussion. You will recall, if you look back at the information, that this is a measure that in the face-to-face meeting did not pass the importance criteria, so was not evaluated on the other criteria. However, the group did have a number of questions for the developer. Therefore, this is back to you to look at in terms of the responses to the questions that were posed. In addition to that, we did ask a cardiac interventionalist to take a look at this to provide some feedback to NQF staff. And the cardiac interventionalist did note that the number one factor in documenting whether an endarterectomy patient has a stroke is whether independent neuroevaluation is performed, and comments that this individual has seen a dozen or more patients listed as normal at discharge who had had a stroke.
Wow, that's a lot.
This is Ken Rosenfield. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm not sure when the appropriate time to comment is, I'm representing the proposers of this measure. So please let me know when is the appropriate time to say something.
Thank you. And I think that probably Dr. Morris and Dr. Torchiano will want to have the group take a look at the written responses that came in and then open it for your comments. Dr. Morris, Dr. Torchiano, is that how you'd like to proceed?
Yeah, that would be great.
Well, I personally think it's important, I speak as a vascular surgeon, that there is a good thing to have a standardized way of doing a neurologic assessment. The question is, how do you determine what's independent if it's within your group and then make it easier for collecting? And my problem is the data collection and how that's going to be done as compared to what people are normally doing in the community now. So are people going to need to completely change their practice, and who's going to do the independent assessment? I think it's an important thing to measure to make sure people are actually doing a neurologic assessment in some kind of standardized way. But the question is how to make it so that people can actually do this and meet this measure.
Do you want me to comment on that? Or I'm not sure how this should work.
Well, I think that those are basically the major issues that came up in our discussion, as I recall. If anybody else in the steering committee has issues that we'd also like the measure developer or representative of the measure developer to comment on, this is probably a good time to bring those up. Anybody else on the steering committee with comments?
I guess the only other comment that I would have is that, so what, you do the assessment. It's just like, did they have DVT prophylaxis ordered? Yes. Well, it doesn't necessarily mean that they got it. So just because you do the assessment doesn't necessarily mean that anything happens with the data and that it goes any further. So,
well, I think the developer's concern, and they can correct me if I'm wrong, is that people aren't really – and I have to say I hate to admit it, but I think that's probably true, that there's not really a standardized way of measuring neurologic outcomes for carotid interventions on many people's side. You know, they come to your office, you check them out, they seem okay, and that's about it. So I think it's important to try and encourage people to have a standardized measure of outcome. But again, it depends on what this is going to be used for, other than to say that people are doing it or not doing it.
Right, and I think then the other issue, looking at our comments, was about the examiner. Whether that was going to have to be – that there was a requirement that the assessment be done by an American Stroke Association certified examiner. How are you going to do that? What was that going to add to cost and all sorts of other things? I think those were the other issues, if I remember right.
Yeah, the feasibility of it.
Right.
Other thing was the question of the assessment being done prior to 21
right.
days.
Right.
All right. Any other issues to be addressed? Why don't you go ahead and talk to us about your response?
Let me just start by saying that your comments are great. Your questions are great. This measure is as with anything you do, you know, if you're doing something to prevent stroke, then you should be looking to see whether you had prevented stroke or whether the patients had a stroke after the procedure. And, the question is, when's the right time to measure it? Most every study, most every practice, is, I think, bound, in fact, the RUC, the payment for carotid endarterectomy and for carotid stenting is bundled and includes post-operative and post-procedure visits out to 90 days. And within that is included up to three visits that are actually paid for and should, by all rights, include an assessment of whether the patient has benefited or certainly whether they've suffered from the intervention that you do. So, I almost, as a practitioner, as a patient, I would say it's almost a commitment that the person who's doing the procedure should ensure that that the patient has actually benefited. You wouldn't do a bypass operation on a leg without actually looking to see that the result has been beneficial. As far as the timing, there are a certain number of events that happen post-discharge, and most would agree that the 30-day time point is probably the plus-minus 30-day time point is the appropriate time to measure for getting the optimal capture rate, if you will, without actually going too far out. A neurologist would say they'd like to see it 1 year if the patient's benefited, but I think that's the correlation between 30 days and 1 year is actually quite good. So we think that 30 days is reasonable, and I think we've changed the measure in response in part to your questions to 14. It's 30 days, but as short as 14 days, as long as 60 days. As far as what the measure is, it's actually quite simple. An NIH stroke scale by a certified examiner, one can, with literally a couple of hours online, become a certified stroke scale examiner, and it can be a nurse, it can be a nursing assistant, it could even theoretically be a secretary or somebody, but I think it's most would say a nurse or nursing assistant or somebody of that ilk. It does not have to be a neurologist, and in fact, some would argue it shouldn't be. It should be somebody that's, sort of standardized at obtaining a very basic set of parameters. These are the measures that are used for all of the basic measures, pared down, that are used in all of the studies for stenting and endarterectomy, and that's what this is hitched to, if you will. The registries, the SVS registry and the NCDR registry, both include these metrics. I will tell you that for almost every stent patient over the past 15 years, these things have been measured at 30 days. The same is not true for endarterectomy, but unless you're participating in one of the many trials that have been carried out for this for these therapies. So basically, this is an attempt to standardize on the part of the patients, on behalf of the patients, what are the outcomes for these procedures. We do have, between the SVS registry and the NCDR registry, we have the mechanism to obtain these results. They can be done in any private physician's office. There is obviously the opportunity for bias if you're a cardiologist, for example, and your nurse is the person obtaining the stroke scale, or if you're a surgeon and it's your nurse obtaining it. But at least it's better than what happens now, which is pretty much which is often, as you pointed out, nothing, or a poor, as the cardiologist who did the review said, a relatively inaccurate assessment of whether the patient's actually had a stroke or not. Torch would know that at our institution, this has now become a formalized program where patients with any form of carotid revascularization have immediate post-procedure and 30-day assessment that's done by an independent neurologic assessor, and it works incredibly well. So I think I should stop and see if there are any other questions. It is not an expensive item. It's literally a less than 5 minutes exam that could be done by, again, the non-physician provider.
All right. Thank you. Yeah, that actually provides quite a bit of clarity when you said that it's an online course that could be done by a variety of different kinds of people. So that makes it seem potentially less cumbersome.
How do they collect it? Who's collecting the data?
Would this be something that would be recorded in a post-operative visit with the surgeon?
Presumably, yes.
Okay. And one of the primary issues from my perspective, Mrs. Arden, is the fact that it didn't pass importance to measure and report. Does the steering committee want to discuss why for us it didn't pass importance to measure and report? Was that primarily because it wasn't strongly linked to an improvement in outcome?
Hello? I just lost.
The two issues that the group identified were the link to improvement in outcome and the ability to retrieve the information, and then the certified examiner piece.
As far as the measure itself, it is a process measure. It is not, that was mentioned. We believe you got to walk before you run. We want to make sure that people are actually measuring this, and we believe actually that will, if people are measuring and they know they're being measured, we believe that actually will impact outcome and who's doing these things.
Who's collecting the data to be put into this measure? Is this coming from the hospital? Or are you expecting individual physicians to participate in a registry?
So it would be hospital-based, but likely through a registry that is hospital-based. Most hospitals are now participating in these registries. And, in fact, we believe CMS is poised. They have said that they will are poised to certify registries as part of the ability, for example, to perform carotid revascularization with stenting anyway.
This is Dr. Anderson, also an interventional cardiologist representing the developer. I would also point out that for many, many cardiac procedures, both percutaneous as well as surgical, hospitals are already collecting some outcomes, typically around 30 days, information on the patients. So the use of a measure like this would not greatly change what many hospitals are already doing now.
This is the same aspect, but are we looking at, I see this as a different measure than something that's going to improve outcomes. It seems like it's more that it's going to help standardize an important process in care. And obviously the collection of that information can then be looked at. But is this is that accurate to say that it helps standardize and create some guidelines for how care should be provided?
How outcomes would be measured. Yes, that's correct. It would standardize at a very base level how outcomes should be measured for carotid revascularization, which would then enable, of course, evaluation of those outcomes.
So I'm thinking of the person who's operating out of a community hospital where all their surgeons are private surgeons, and then the hospital has to go to the office or get somebody to fax them the information of the neurologic exam. I don't practice in a community, but I'm just wondering how we see this happening in a community-based hospital.
So I guess the answer to that would be yes. The hospital would be, my view is if the hospital wants to support a program which enables carotid revascularization, then they and the surgeons and interventionalists who do the procedures should be committed to being able to look at the outcomes of their procedures. That to me is sort of fundamental. We don't just do things and say, okay, we're done and wash our hands of it. In fact, the codes include a bundle of a requirement to look at the patient in the post-operative period out to 90 days.
Yeah, but people do that in their – what I'm saying is if we're requiring hospitals to do this now, I mean, people do that in their office. They may not be doing it well, but they're doing it. I can't imagine a surgeon not seeing their patient post-op. Then you're requiring hospitals now to collect that data.
But for major cardiac procedures, including community hospitals, many of them, I can't speak to say most, but many of them are already doing that, contacting the patients directly or in many cases contacting the provider physician's office generally at around 30 days for various kinds of information anyway. And many times the hospitals couple it with a quality interest questionnaire. You know, did you like the food? Was the parking adequate? You know, they couple it with some other information that they desire to have from a more of a business operation standpoint. So for many cardiac procedures, this sort of contact with the patient or the provider is already occurring.
Okay. I think the importance is there. I don't know why we invite. I don't actually remember why we said not important.
This is Christine. I have a question that may have been answered, and I may have missed it. Is this recommended by the American Society of Vascular Surgeons?
No, it's this. This is being put forth through American Heart Association, but I don't think that the Society for Vascular Surgery and their quality database that is sort of being rolled out now and getting increasing momentum, it has similar requirements for a 30-day assessment post-carotid intervention. So their database would have similar requirements.
So do they require this exact exam? What was the exam? It's not just any neuro exam. What did you
say? The NIH stroke scale, but that, okay. I think that's a pretty standard exam for as the developers mentioned, for anybody participating in any study. It's the exam that's used to make it uniform across any study that's being done for carotid interventions.
So I'm just wondering, does the SVS specifically call out this study?
I don't know that they have it in there. I haven't looked at the database, but I can tell you anybody who's participating in a study in the SVS and that's sort of where this database is started, used this stroke exam.
So there are about 180 hospitals that participate in the NCDR, which is the American College of Cardiology database for carotid stenting. There, as you know, something like 1,500 or 1,800 hospitals that participate in the NCDR's coronary PET-CAF PCI database, which also requires a 30-day follow-up. Now, the SVS's database, there is an expanding number. I don't know exactly how many, but it was about 80 or 100. It's, I think, expanding, which is good. And they are requiring a 30-day neurologic evaluation. And I believe that through their affiliation with the blanking on the name of it, but the other approval body, the one that does the eye cable exam,
yes.
they also will be requiring
the SBU.
Yeah. So they also will be requiring an NIH stroke scale, which is a very basic exam.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I don't know if Tim Cressa is on the call. Tim and I had a long conversation after the last call, and he expressed the fact that the SVS would be supporting this measure.
Yes.
Sorry that he's not on the call.
Okay. Could I ask a question? Did Ken or anyone else have an estimate of what the denominator is here? If we've got hospitals in the hundreds doing this already, how many hospitals do carotids?
Oh, wow.
Well, there are about 1,000, a little over 1,000 hospitals that have applied, that have gotten certification by CMS to be able to do carotid stenting, which just requires an affidavit by your head administrator. But in terms of the numbers that are actually doing it, it's, I think, significantly less. I don't know how many are doing endarterectomy, Torch.
Okay. I mean, there's about 1,000 that do heart surgery. So
I think there's probably more that do CEAs because they're kind of the bread and butter of vascular surgery.
That would have been my guess.
Probably right.
Yeah.
I'm guessing it's, 1,200 or 1,500. I don't know.
We have a vascular surgeon on our panel. Is that person on this call?
Yeah, that's me. I'm talking.
Oh, great. Sorry.
Yes.
So you're supportive of this?
Yes, I am. I think it's important to standardize how we assess our interventions.
Apologize.
Is Terry Rogers on the call?
I'm sorry?
Is Terry Rogers on the call? There's a reason that we decided that this did not pass the importance to measure and report criteria. I am wondering if that reason is because there wasn't evidence that the process measure is linked to improvement in outcome, and if that's what sort of swayed us in the very beginning. But I think that we really need to address that. Not that I want to spend a lot more time talking about this individual measure, but I do think that we need to cover that issue. I dropped the call a little while ago, and so I don't know if that was discussed in my absence. Can you guys tell me?
It was not. None of us seemed to remember why we thought it wasn't important before.
It's Melinda.
Okay.
The issue was
the feasibility of collecting the information that would be needed for the measure in light of what the group characterized as little evidence that the process measure was strongly linked to improvement in outcome.
Okay, I think
so
that
was the rationale.
Issue, I think the feasibility issue was actually fairly well addressed here by our developer. What about the absence of a link between the process and an improvement in outcome? Vivian, what's your perspective on that?
Well, I think, as the developer mentioned, I think that if you make people pay more attention to what they're doing, they may find that they need to, you know, they may find issues that they didn't realize actually existed, subtle neurologic changes, and so they may end up changing their outcomes based on their findings. But if you don't start somewhere in terms of standardizing how people assess how good their outcomes are after carotid intervention, then you may never discover whether there needs to be improvement or not.
Okay. So what we're trying to do here is to improve measures for which there is evidence of a we're trying to recommend endorsement of measures for which there's evidence of quality improvement. I think it seems to me that the evidence that was put forward is that right now there's a terrible job being done and that a substantial proportion of patients who have had strokes aren't being recognized. So to me, that evidence isn't very direct, but it actually sounds like pretty good indirect evidence for importance here. Does anybody disagree with that?
Just some clarification. Would this be a measure regardless of whether it's carotid stenting or carotid endarterectomy?
Yes. Right. I think that's the case, right? It's for any carotid intervention.
Both. Yes.
Yeah, I think there's a need to standardize and to measure both. It's kind of like mom and apple pie, I think, but that's my point.
All right. So where do we go next with this, Melinda?
Whenever this one goes out for vote, there will be a need to vote on all of the criteria. And then if it passes the criteria, it'll be the question will be, does it meet all the criteria, and then the question for endorsement. So in this case, the committee is going to have to look at all of the criteria and vote on all of the criteria.
So we'll be essentially just revisiting this entire
That's correct. And you have the information from the developer related to the testing, which you had asked for. So you do have additional information to consider at that point.
Yeah, I think that sounds worthwhile. I think that revisiting this measure sounds worthwhile. Anybody disagree with that? Okay, maybe we can move on to the next one then.
So the next one is 0339, pediatric heart surgery mortality. I think there were a couple of things with respect to this. You'll remember that this measure was also considered in looking at a standard mortality ratio, and the group made some recommendations in that those measures should be combined and then paired with 340. And the developer had agreed to pursue that. So I believe that what we need to do is hear from the developer, because I think we've not yet gotten the formal response to that. Is that correct, Alexis?
Yes, they're currently working on combining the measure, and they will have that submitted by August 15th. And the two developers have been conversing with each other on how to create the newly combined measure.
And Dr. Gephardt's online, and Dr. Gephardt, if you've been working with this, perhaps the group would like to hear some comments from you, and then we'll hold this one over until we have a formal response.
Sure. So there were three measures, remember. There was one measure that was registry-based that was an OE ratio, a standardized mortality ratio. And then there were two measures, the RQI measure and the Children's Hospital of Boston measure, that were both reported as a rate, a risk-adjusted rate. And so what we've been doing is having a series of conference calls with the folks at the Children's Hospital to harmonize our administrative data specification. And so that's what we'll be submitting on August 15th, is the harmonized administrative data specification for pediatric heart surgery.
Okay. So Dr. Morrison, Dr. Torchiano, unless there's additional discussion you want to have at this point, we will add these two measures to the discussion for August 3rd and or 4th.
That sounds good.
Well, it won't be done by August 3rd or 4th.
But I think it might have to be after that.
Yeah, that's correct. They have until August 15th to submit the measures.
Okay.
So whatever the next call is after that, I would imagine.
Yes.
And that may mean that we need to schedule a call specifically for that, but we will do so. So then we move to 352.
It's Jeff Silber. I'm here.
Hi, Dr. Silber.
Hi.
So this is failure to rescue in hospital mortality, and there is also the measure that follows that, 353, is also one that Dr. Silber will represent, and that's failure to rescue, and that's 30-day mortality. So the group had some questions that it had posed. Related to age range disparities and use in public reporting. Dr. Morrison, Dr. Torchiano, did you want the group to go ahead and have some discussion, or do you want to hear from Dr. Silber at this point?
Yeah, I see the three issues raised.
Okay.
I would imagine that I don't know if there are other issues to be discussed. Does anyone in the group have issues other than the three raised? Or should we just hear from Dr. Silber?
I think that those are, I think we should hear from Dr. Silber, but we also need a response on the plans and expected date for public reporting, which I don't think was addressed in the developer responses.
So, Dr. Silber?
Okay, sure. We gave a written response to all three. The
am I missing it on the next page? It's on the next page. I apologize.
Okay. The age range question, We've thought for many years about this and have published for many years using the 90-day cut point, for example, the age 90 cut point, as well as in the recent JAMA papers for mortality. In terms of failure to rescue, we thought it made sense that after age 90, the ability for us to fine-tune any of the severity adjustment for failure to rescue might be difficult, since there might be a different threshold used for salvaging patients after complications. And it's not a huge numbers problem, but it is, we thought, to be fair to all hospitals, it's better to keep the 90-day ceiling. All hospitals are being treated the same day with the, but I keep saying 90-day, I mean 90-year ceiling. All hospitals are being treated the same way, and if you were going to be assessing quality at these hospitals, I would doubt that someone who was greater than 90 would be misled by looking at the data up through 90 if they were someone who indeed wanted to, or their family wanted them to not fail after a complication. So to us, in terms of the validity of the measure, it made more sense to truncate it at 90. We also did the same thing with mortality rates, as I said, and have published that for many years. So I wouldn't necessarily want to change the measure now, and we haven't had a hard time publishing with that, with those definitions, and it was really the first time we've heard that as a significant criticism, and the reason that we're doing it is to do a little bit better of a job in terms of severity adjustment for those 90 and below. So, I would hate to change it at this point, and I don't think there's a compelling reason to change it. So we kind of explained, we published on it. This is the measure. It would be uniform across all hospitals. It's always been that way. And we're just saying we trust the measure a little bit less in patients greater than 90. We've written some papers on DNR over the years, and the DNR status doesn't fix things because DNR status is very variable at different hospitals as well, the way they're recorded, et cetera. So we did not change the measure on the suggestion that was made or the comment that was made. We thought the measure that's been used for the last 20 years wouldn't change because of a worry about patients greater than 90. And we could certainly in the future do some research studies to see if the failure to rescue correlation between those less than 90 and greater than 90 was there, but the numbers would be pretty small. So, in terms of disparities, we published on disparities with differences in failure to rescue. And in terms of public reporting, our intent is to have this be something that would be available for use in public reporting. We certainly have made the measure public. So I'm not quite sure what the requirement is or the request is, but for that, except to say that it's something that people have used, are using, and we hope will continue to use. And if we would not be certified by NQF, then it would just be, we think, a shame that people couldn't use this measure for public reporting when they wanted to, especially if someone reports the death rate and the complication rate. We think it's very important that they also report the failure to rescue rate, at the very least because of gaming that can occur if you don't report all three. So, and we've published on that. Any specific questions on the GLIT?
And you also addressed the pediatric question in your first section of your written response.
Right. We have, over the years, we put in some grants on, which we haven't been funded yet, on pediatric FTR. There, we'd have to create a definition a little different than death because there's generally not enough deaths. But in some diseases, there are enough, and we have been developing a pediatric heart surgery FTR measure, but that's something for the future.
So my question is, how does this square, unless I'm looking at the wrong data, how does this square or harmonize with the AHRQ patient safety indicator
in terms of
age and other issues?
Well, I'll give you the history of the, I guess the, or others could talk about the ARC safety measure. They basically took my measure, which was developed in 1990, and then somewhere in the 2000s, decided that it would be nice to look at specific complications, a subset of complications, and then make a failure to rescue measure on the subset of relevant complications thought to be nurse sensitive or complications that in some way they defined as more relevant than others. And created a failure to rescue measure using a subset of the original complications that I put forth. I had a theory as to how to choose the complications they needed to cover, trying to get to 95% of the deaths. So if you died, it was most likely that you had one of these complications. In the ARC measure that came out after mine, that measure didn't use that theory. They just said, we'll just choose some complications. Then I wrote a paper in 2009 in Medical Care describing the great problem and the great, I believe, mistake in using the measure that doesn't use all complications, because you therefore don't count all the deaths. And so you end up getting a very unstable measure, and the reliability goes down because you literally cut the death rate, in other words, the number of deaths following complications, you cut that in half. The statistic becomes much more unstable. And I published a paper showing that and expressing my great concern in terms of the use of the ARC measure. Now, that continues to be used by NQF, and you know, you can decide whether you're comfortable with that, but I did write a paper that I think made sense, which showed that it was probably not a good idea. Furthermore, the complications that were excluded by the ARC measure but were included in mine, the ones that were excluded, were just as informative in terms of the failure to rescue rates as the complications that were included. So the instability of the measure after you reduce the number of deaths that can be counted, because you're not counting all the deaths. In mine, you count all the deaths. In the ARC measures, you don't count all the deaths. You only count the deaths after their specific complications. The instability is, I think, a great problem. And then there's a gaming problem, which is if you want to have a better failure rescue measure, and you'd like to be able to hide deaths. In my measure, you can't hide a death. But in the ARC measure, if you don't record certain specific complications but record others, you might be able to hide a death because you didn't quite define the complication as the one that was in the special ARC group. So I thought it was a mistake, both because I don't want the unstable measure, and secondly, I would never want to dismiss deaths. I don't want to not count deaths in terms of a measure that I'm measuring. And so, therefore, I thought it made more sense to stay with the original measure, and that's why I went to you 3 years ago and wanted the measure as part of NQF. But so they are very different measures, in the sense that one uses half the deaths as the other, and they're based on the ARC measure is based on a subset of complications, and I've shown that the reliability is worse. So I would absolutely want and believe that the right measure is the original failure to rescue measure and the one that we've been publishing on for many years. And I think it's, you know, it is at least it is as worthy, and I think it is the right measure to use if you're interested in looking at the dimension of quality that's related to failure to rescue.
Okay, and we're not actually comparing the two measures right now. I think what we're doing is looking at this measure. Isn't that correct?
Well, I was asked about the other measure.
That question.
Right. No, it's Renee, and no, I understand that. I'm just, as we're also looking at harmonizing things. I mean, my bias is that I think it's absolutely important, and in fact, why should it be just general surgery, orthopedic, and vascular? I mean, to be quite honest with you, if we really wanted to include all the deaths, I'd look at every surgical patient.
Dr. Morris is absolutely correct. The evaluation of the two measures, this measure and the ARC measure, will be part of the related and competing discussion, and there, so we can bring to that some of the rationale. At the time, both measures were recommended for endorsement.
Yeah.
Are there more questions from the steering committee about this measure? Renee, do you have anything else?
Oh, nope.
We feel like the questions and issues were sufficiently answered. All right, let's go ahead and move on.
So then 353 is the companion measure that is the 30-day mortality measure, failure to rescue.
I think pretty pretty much it was all the same. They were all the same issues.
Right.
I don't think we necessarily need any more discussion on that.
The additional question was to was asking about how the 30-day data is collected and how post-hospital care with potential to affect the outcome is handled in the measure.
Right, and as I pointed out in the last when the call before the last call, there are many, many 30-day measures using claims data. If one is lucky enough to have linkable data like Medicare data, then one can construct a 30-day measure because Medicare data is linked. If you don't have 30-day data, but instead you don't have linkable data, but you have only in-hospital data, say, for example, HCOP data, then you need the in-hospital measure. But if you have linkable data, that's always a good thing. And that's why 30 days is kind of the gold standard, because you don't have the bias of some hospitals discharging patients faster than others and then having a better mortality rate, or in our case, a failure to rescue rate, if you could avoid the death by discharging quickly. But if you have a uniform 30-day follow-up, whether you discharge the patient and get them to die outside the hospital or have them die in the hospital, you're going to be catching both of those. So we always would prefer a 30-day measure, if we can get linked data to measure that. And so that's why we wanted, when we were presented this originally, we had one measure called failure to rescue, which could be used as 30-day or in-hospital, and then you had us divided into two measures, a 30-day measure and an in-hospital measure. But we've always thought, you know, if you can do the 30-day, you would do the 30-day. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of the gold standard for mortality, because you're having a fair comparison by hospitals that isn't affected by the style of their discharge, their style of length of stay, for example. Does that answer the question? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think that addresses the question. The question was really around, okay, how will it be collected? So, yeah, there's linkable data for folks who are over the age of 65, that could be collected. For folks under the age of 65, it might be a little bit more complicated.
Right.
For hospitals.
And you might, if you don't have linkable data, then you're stuck with in-hospital.
And we're stuck with what
right.
we do have.
But if you're lucky to have linkable data, then sometimes you can get that for younger populations. But
okay. Any other questions or issues around this measure? Let's move on to the next one.
And the next one is 351, death among surgical inpatients with serious treatable complications. This is an ARC measure. And the questions here were actually a request to expand the age range to include a larger population. And the developer responded by saying that there was an error in the form which noted age 75 and older were excluded, when in fact the exclusion is 90 and older, and that was the single question.
Okay, that's very
ARC.
Simple.
So I guess the only thing I would say is that that's interesting, because their website the measure still says 75.
Ah, that is interesting.
I just pulled it up a little while ago.
Anybody
as we were
from ARC on the line?
Talking about all this.
Yeah, we'll. This is John, but we'll correct that when the subsequent version comes out, which is expected to occur shortly.
Hmm. Okay.
Otherwise, I don't have anything else to.
Okay.
Okay.
Let's move on
to 1536. And this is improvement in patient visual function within 90 days following cataract surgery. And this was one of two measures that were submitted, and the follow-on, or the second measure, was patient perception of improvement.
Mm-hmm.
And that measure has been withdrawn. It was a measure that was an SCAPS measure, essentially, patient satisfaction. And the SCAPS developer is actually going to submit the SCAPS measure, which removes this developer from being in the rather difficult circumstance of submitting someone else's measure in order to get at what they would like to know. So they have the information that that the SCAPS developer is submitting that measure, and then they will be able to use it to collect the patient satisfaction. So they have withdrawn that measure, 1549, and so it remains a single measure for consideration for cataract improvement of visual function within 90 days following surgery.
We had some pretty complicated questions for the developer.
Yes.
And who is the lead person on this? Barnaby, is our lead discussant on the line? Doesn't sound like it.
The other thing that we highlighted for you is this was one where the group had voted in a conditional fashion with 9 yeses, 10 noes in terms of meeting criteria.
Right.
So on page 40 and 41 of your 49-page document, there are the questions that were posed for the developer and the developer responses.
Let's take these one at a time, because particularly the first one seems fairly complicated to me, the numerator details. So just to sort of refresh, we asked for the method to define improvement. We made a comment about whether it was inappropriate to include patients who didn't complete a visual function assessment. We asked for them to indicate whether objective or subjective improvement was going to be provided, and I believe that was by the SCAPS, right, Melinda?
No, this would be the visual function questionnaire.
Yeah, the objective would be the exam. The subjective is the tool that they've identified for this measure.
Okay. And then lastly, whether the patient would be surveyed pre- or post-surgery. So in terms of the response to the numerators, quantitative scale, and they gave us detail about the scale, which is actually, I think, seems very complete to me. Talked about the minimal clinically important difference. Cases that did not complete visual function instruments would not be included. It is subjective improvement by the patient survey, and they are surveyed both pre- and post-operative, so that seems appropriate. Does anybody want to discuss further the condition number one?
No, I think they pretty well have answered the question.
I thought so, too, yeah. In terms of the denominator, we wanted for them to address whether how they would deal with excluding patients who did not want to complete the survey. And they said that they would not exclude those patients. For three, asked about the specific tool for the measure. And they actually answered that pretty thoroughly in the answer to number one. I don't think we need to review all of that again. The use in public reporting. And they just gave us the statement that it's planned within the next 3 years. And then lastly, the burden on providers. Use of a third party should significantly alleviate the burden on providers, and the financial support for that would be using a registry. So providers would not be responsible for collecting the data, and the registry would be supported by the academy. What do you guys think about that last one? That data collection strategy.
Well, I think it's interesting. It certainly keeps you keeps the providers from biasing the patients.
Well, that's true. Absolutely. And it alleviates the immediate burden on the providers.
Exactly.
They first pay a tax if they belong to the academy. They pay a tax
right.
that supports the registry.
Right.
We still don't really know. So do the providers have to be members of the academy to have the data collected by the registry since it's supported by the academy? Is the developer on the line, and can you answer that question?
Yes. Well, about 94% of all practicing ophthalmologists do belong to the academy. So we do have a very large share of membership. Currently, it is open to academy members, but if the measure, I think we could include non-academy members as well.
Okay. What does the committee think about that?
I think that's pretty reasonable.
I agree.
Yeah, I agree as well.
A lot of discussion about registry participation previously. Okay. In that case, anything else to discuss with regard to this measure? Okay, let's move on to the next one.
So the next one is 0125, timing of antibiotic prophylaxis. And trying to get on the right page. Okay, that's on page 44 of 49. And there were just two questions for the developer, one on addressing the rating of the evidence. And
hi, can I have a density test, caramel macchiato ice?
Someone.
I need a third one.
Can I have one too?
Yeah, we'd all like one. So there are two questions. Addressing the rating of the evidence and exact timing of the antibiotic.
Okay. And do we have our steering committee member who was introducing this measure present on the line?
I think I was the one. This is Christine.
Okay. What do you think of the developer responses to this? Does this adequately cover our questions, address the rating of the evidence, and their response is it's addressed in the measure submission form?
One of the things I remember us talking about that was beyond the rating of the evidence, it was the gap that it seemed like
right.
this was one that had that really wasn't relevant as a quality measure because the gap was so small. That's what I remember from our discussion.
So maybe the way that we phrased the condition or question for the developer was not appropriate.
Yeah, maybe so.
We wanted more information about the gap. How about the second item, provide the exact timing of the prophylactic antibiotic? Do you recall that that was present in the original measure submission?
Yeah, well, I remember we were talking about the data. You know, we reviewed, there were a number of articles that came out, I think American College of Surgeons, and there was a lot of discussion. There was some, I believe it was from the developer comment, that there's some new research that's going to come out supporting the timing. But there was just a lot of lack of clarity about really the science behind this exact cutoff time. And then there was some discussion that people felt, well, you have to find some cutoff, but then there was that big VA study. I'm just going back in my memory banks. There was a big VA study that showed that after implementing this with really high performance over a period of, 5 years or 3 years, that there was no difference in outcomes.
Yep, right.
So we really had a question about the utility of this measure.
We really did.
Melinda, what are our options here? It sounds like we didn't actually phrase our question number one appropriately for the developer.
Yeah,
question
so
number two. Sort of dodgy.
So do we have the developer on the line? Because they're saying that it is included in the measure submission, and so they might be able to help us see that. and whether that was in the original submission that we all saw or if they updated the measure submission, we can get that out to the group. So do we have a representative of...
I'm sorry to interrupt. I think that the problem here is that it wasn't really a question about the rating of the evidence as much as it was a question of is there any gap here. But we didn't really put that forward to them in a way that they could answer.
Right, and I don't remember if this was one of the ones that we talked about having some old data.
Exactly, it was.
Articles.
Yes. And there was recent data that came out in the last 2 years, that VA study, and then there was another study. But I think it was in the Journal of the American College of Surgeons, maybe. And then there was some comment that, well, there's going to be a new study coming out that's not out yet that shows that this timing is right. But there was really nothing other than old data to show that. And then there was the gap. So there were really two issues. There was the gap, but then there was really, there's starting to be a question about a link between quality outcomes and this measure.
And were we asking for newer evidence? With this?
No, we had really new evidence.
Okay.
Yeah, they provided some updated specifications on page 45 with some newer references, at least 2007.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's adequate.
And some guidelines that are already out there.
Tom Burson, I think part of the issue at the meeting was there's not a lot of evidence at the moment that these individual measures have any effect on SSI rates.
That's right.
The outcome link, but that there was some discussion at the group about whether it was still important to have the antibiotic stewardship to address. And that stopping antibiotics was important as well. I believe
right.
that.
Right. There was some evidence
would this be one of those measures that could be put in the, what is it called, the reserve or whatever?
Sure. But... again, you would again, this is Helen Burson. You would only want to put into reserve status a measure that is otherwise, you know, reliable, valid, evidence-based. And I think the question you're asking is, does this one still need to exist in terms of if the evidence now suggests there's not a relationship to the rate of surgical site infections? There's now that large VA study and then the Premier study as well, that really only the R-none composite had any effect.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah, one of those two studies said that if you take them all together, it looked like there was
right.
evidence, but not as individual measures.
Gamma. Right. So an R-none composite of all the skip antibiotic measures did show a reduction in SSIs. The VA study, though, incorporated other patient factors and nothing was related. But I believe the issue with the steering committee, when we talked about this, is also that there may be benefits beyond the reduction in SSIs and this question of, you know, being a good antibiotic steward. So that's what I think he needs to consider.
Right, and that had to do with, I think, stopping the antibiotic and the savings, cost savings, when it's, there's absolutely no evidence that continuing it provides any additional protection.
Exactly, yes. That was the discussion.
Yeah, but that was not the timing one.
That's probably right. Okay.
Yeah, that had nothing to do with timing. That was the one...
That's the next one, right?
Yeah, this is, the timing one is the one that was the most controversial. I think the selection of antibiotic, there was not a lot of discussion. The stopping the antibiotic, there was not, but this timing one was the one where there was not strong support.
Okay.
It had to do with the gap, and it had to do with the evidence and the recent evidence that this there's not a relationship between this and better outcomes. And then I think there's some of the studies that were brought to the fore were older studies. So I don't know what we do in a case like this. Is we revisit it or?
That's kind of what we're doing right now, I suppose. Although it's tempting to just say there's not much more to say here.
Yeah.
It
has to be watched closely because the data coming out really looks like it is not an effective measure. So
by itself.
By itself, right.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's 4:56 by the clock on my wall. And so the question is whether or not you're going to have the time to continue or is this a point at which you want to stop and we go back and collect the additional information that you've just spoken to and we bring from 125 pick back up here whenever we have our next call.
I say we should bring it back when we have our next call.
I agree.
It'll give us all a chance to do a little more looking.
Yeah, and we're happy to share those articles if you guys haven't seen them.
Okay, thank you. What about the other measures? Are we going to need to postpone our discussion of them?
I think so, given the hour, unless folks have more time to devote to this today.
I'm going to have to leave shortly.
Yeah, I'm going to have to leave as well.
Okay. You know, I'd like to make a request, and that is to Melinda and Alexis in particular, that it seems like we've had some of the folks who were responsible for introducing the measures on the call. For the remaining measures, I'm assuming that we'll be discussing them in a future call. I think it's important to try and target the times that these steering committee members will be present, if we can at all. I know that you're probably going for the majority, but I think that their input will be particularly important.
Okay, and our next call actually is the 3rd of August, so we can take a look back and see about their availability on that date.
Okay. Sometimes even sending an extra email or two to really urge somebody to be on the call can have an effect.
Yes, and if that doesn't work, we've got calls for both the 3rd and the 4th. We can look at their availability on the 4th and then see if we need to flip back and forth between the two dates or do it at another time, we can do that.
That sounds good. All right. Now, do we need to have a time for a member in public comment here before we disperse?
Yes, we do.
Okay. Anybody else? Anybody object to moving ahead to that right now? Let's go ahead and do that.
Melanie, can you please open the lines for comment?
Yes, all lines are open.
Hello, is there anybody on the public member and public line that would like to speak to the discussion so far?
Sounds like a wrap.
Yeah. Yes, it does.
Okay, so in terms of next steps, we've already mentioned we've got a call coming up on the 3rd and one also on the 4th. With the stated intent of looking at related and competing measures, we know we're going to bring the remaining 6 measures forward to a subsequent call. And we also have a request to take an additional look at measure 515 with the hair removal measure. So we'll have that one with the comments for consideration at one of the subsequent calls. Alexis, is there anything else?
No.
Okay, so Dr. Morris, Dr. Corciana, anything final, and we're ready to wrap up.
Nothing else for me. I'd like to thank all of the people present on the call for your input.
You're so nice. Thank you.
Thank you all.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye now.
Bye. Bye.